Blog Talk Radio.
You know my starter won't start this morning. Boy, and my motor won't even turn. You know my starter won't start this morning. Boy, and my motor won't even turn. You know I've been running with a fast class of women. Now they've called my little car to run.
Chatter Radio here on blogtalkradio.com. I am Chris Block, writer, editor, and keeper of thethirdmanin.com, puckchatter.com, here on this New Year's Day special edition, Tuesday, January the 1st, 2013, 202 here in Chicago. On the show today, I have a guest here. I think he and I see the world a little bit differently. We're kind of like Gary Bettman and Don Fear. We speak different languages, but he is, he's truly an independent hockey mind. He's formerly of ESPNChicago.com and HockeyIndependent.com, MyFoxChicago.com, and also the Chicago correspondent on Sirius XM Radio. He is Al Samaglia. How you doing tonight, Al?
Good to be with you, Chris. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. A lot to talk about. I want to get in and speak about a few things right off the top of the bat. Normally, we talk Rockford Icehogs on this show. I have been incommunicado for the last few days. The Icehogs have played 3 games in, 5 days or something like that. I haven't seen a solitary second of any of it. So we're not really going to talk about it. I know that last night in Grand Rapids on New Year's Eve, the Icehogs had a big game with first place on the line with the Grand Rapids Griffins. Icehogs didn't do too well in that game. They lost. So really big game in terms of the Icehogs. Were tied with points with Grand Rapids, but the Griffins had 3 games in hand. So that was really a big game for the Icehogs to win. Not the end of the world. You still got more than half the season left. But two games this weekend for the Icehogs in Hamilton on Friday and then Saturday afternoon in Toronto. They turn around, and then they have 2 games in a row with Grand Rapids next week. So those will be essential to win. But there's your Rockford Icehogs update. The only thing I really know is that Jimmy Hayes got benched in the third period last night. Jimmy Hayes struggling right now. 13 games without a goal. I only glanced at the score sheet. I don't think he got a point. So that's 2 assists over the last 13 games. Both those assists came in 1 game. So no goals in 13 games for Jimmy Hayes. Not looking out. Not working out real well for him right now. Struggling. But what we're going to focus on here today, really the big news is the NHL. On the day that we should be talking or should be watching right now, we should be watching the NHL Winter Classic, the Detroit Red Wings and the Toronto Maple Leafs in Ann Arbor at the Big House, and that ain't happening. But maybe not so coincidentally, The NHL and the NHLPA are having serious discussions today, Al. Is this a coincidence or am I out of my mind?
Well, I guess the charade is kind of coming to an end one way or the other. If nothing comes to pass in the next few days, I guess we're without hockey this season. If you could take Gary Bettman seriously about wanting at least a 48-game schedule, I think much less than that would be pretty much a farce. So I think, right now things are are within a few days of coming to a head. Hopefully today, I guess they're going to meet later today. At least that's some of the talk I've seen on Twitter. Hopefully something, you know, more substantial comes to pass. I'm relatively optimistic, although I know better. It's the NHL. I think it's too bad that it's come to this and so much time was wasted and so many games were lost. And, you know, I feel bad for the people that depend on this for a living, you know, the concession workers, people that work in the buildings, and even a lot of people that work with the teams. It's just too bad that it came to this. A lot of this shouldn't have come as a surprise. Should have been more well thought out on both sides ahead of time, but it is what it is, and hopefully it'll lead to some culmination here within the next couple of days.
Yeah, I agree. No matter what side or what your viewpoint is on this, it is a shame that it took this to get to here, to get to this point where it looks like, and I do believe there's going to be an agreement in place over the next 2 weeks. I think we'll be playing or watching. We won't be playing, but we'll be watching NHL hockey here towards the mid to end of this month, January. So, but before we get into all that, I know that, Al, you also want to talk about what the effects of what we're seeing is for sort of the framework of a deal, what will become of the Blackhawks. I know you want to talk about that tonight as well. But before we do any of that, Al, you have a new and interesting venture that you're into that you started up here recently, and why don't you tell the folks a little bit about it?
Well, as some people know, I've been a trader for over 30 years, and last 4 or 5 years I've been thinking about getting into the real estate business as far as becoming an agent, and I finally decided this past summer to do that, and just took the test recently, became an agent, and fortunately just helped a young couple from the South Loop area find a new home in Downers Grove, so closed on a house in mid-December, so that worked out well. And you know, and I'm taking this opportunity now. Obviously, I have more time on my hands without writing anything about hockey. Hopefully, the MyFox Chicago stuff will be picked up soon, and also some of the correspondent work for SiriusXM. But I've had more time, and I've kind of distributed my efforts into some different directions and pointed it actually towards selling real estate, and I've enjoyed it so far. I'm at the ERA Team Feinstein office in Hinsdale. Anyone that has, you know, that lives in the Chicagoland area or lives in the Loop now looking to move out in the western suburbs or has a home in the western suburbs thinking about selling it or buying another one, give me a call and, you know, and I'll do my best to fulfill your needs and talk a little hockey too if that's what you want. And you could reach me at 630-522-2005. And like I say, I'm with the ERA office, Team Feinstein in Hinsdale, and 630-522-2005. And I look forward to hearing from any of you out there that are going to be in need of a purchasing or selling a home in the near future.
And so you're focused mostly on the western suburbs then, Al?
Well, the office is in the western suburbs. The managing broker of the office, the owner, she's a well-thought-of agent in Illinois. She's ranked 68 by the Wall Street Journal reports as far as overall sales last year and second in Illinois. So, you know, we have it's a busy office, and kind of the sweet spot is the western suburbs. But like I say, for people that, you know, thought that it'd be a great idea to live in the city until they had a couple of kids and they have decided maybe now it's best to move out to the burbs, you know, we could service their needs too. But western suburbs, Hinsdale area, Downers Grove, Burr Ridge, Darien, LaGrange, all in that area in western suburbs, certainly, you know, I could help them out. And also, like I say, people that are thinking of moving from the city out to the western burbs.
Hey, and you might end up being neighbors with Coach Q, too.
Coach Q's in the neighborhood, correct.
All right, Al. We have the NHL, you know, everybody remembers and the big press conference on December 6th when Donald Fehr came out. He was the first one to come out and said, we're really close, we're really excited about this. And literally as that was going on, the NHL was firing back saying, no deal, everything's off the table. And Gary Bettman had his now infamous 35-minute bizarre press conference where he was pounding the table and Bill Daly's walking, pacing back and forth, shouting things like, hill we're going to die on. Why is it, I guess, you know, I know that you and I sort of have different views on this, and that's, you know, we're going to get to that. But why do you think it is that it's come to this point, to where we're January 1st, and it's looking like the two sides are like, all right, lock everything down, let's get serious, screw with the hyperbole, let's try to get something done here.
Well, I think if you ask 10 people, you could get 20 different answers about why it's taken so long. And, not being privy to the inside information and being at these meetings, just judging from what I see and what I've heard and things like that, I really don't know if it's just a matter of the way the sport is. It's an easy cop-out to say that, the NHL is a lot different than every other major sport league, but it's a lot different than every other major sports league. You have two countries to deal with. You have many teams that don't have a sniff of making any money who had their best October, November ever because they didn't play a game from a P&L standpoint. You have, not a majority of the teams, but 8 teams or so, maybe 10, depending on how you want to calculate it, that do well and are in big markets. And then you have a big part of the league that is on the borderline, depending on how they do in a particular year. They could come close to breaking even, and if not, they don't. And I just think that, we've progressed a lot over the last 50 years or so as a country, and so has the NHL. But, it wasn't too long ago, really, in some respects, where, just a handful of men sitting in the Sonia Henning room at the old Chicago Stadium, puffing on cigars and drinking fine scotch, were deciding the fate of 120-something hockey players and controlling the league. And we've moved from that point, but it's still somewhat of an evolutionary process that I think that has to take hold. I really think that it's a lot different than, just saying that it's a union, a labor thing. This is different than having a steel mill in a small town, whereby the town's dependent upon, having all those workers in that town have jobs for employment so that they could support the other businesses in town, and the owner of the steel mill is dependent upon those particular workers because without them he basically doesn't have a livelihood. This is different. Don Fehr doesn't have the leverage that he might have in other situations, and we have a lot of owners here that actually every owner, I'd have to say, doesn't need hockey for his financial existence, and many of them have this as I don't want to say a toy, but it's an expensive hobby, more or less. So there's a lot of inequity that has to be worked through, even from the standpoint with the players. I think now what you've seen, though, this time around, is probably more of a divided owners group, whereby, everybody has to look at it from the standpoint for the betterment of the sport, and if 30 teams are going to survive or more, things needed to change. And I think that, the players have to realize that also. They don't have a lot of opportunities. Most of them don't have the opportunity to make a living as well as they can in the NHL anywhere else. So there just really isn't the competition there. And it's a long-winded way of saying that this is just a cluster of a lot of different factions, a lot of different variables. And I think right now it's sad to say, but much of this could have been worked on in the previous year, at least to have a better starting point, a better framework. And when you look at what's going to happen here in the end, was anything really worth it to the players to miss this much time? And I don't think so. I think they've made some strides and proven a couple of points, but at the end of the day, they're still not in a dominant position, and they really never will be.
I want to make one point on something you said that is very interesting, and I've locally here in Chicago, because it was something that was topical, we just came off of the Chicago Public School teacher strike, or, mm-hmm. That negotiation. And it's interesting because in hockey, especially in recent years, there's been this movement, there's not very many buildings left like the Correll Center, whatever they call it now in Ottawa, where it's a building out in the middle of nowhere. There's been this movement to build NHL rinks and dual facilities in town around businesses to thrive up entertainment and business districts. And it's just interesting to me that politicians, most famously Barack Obama, not wanting to really touch what's going on, and local politicians not wanting to get involved when, the NHL, I mean, there's businesses around the United Center that are hurting because there's no, you know, they're missing all these Blackhawk game nights, or they're not doing as well, or they're just, you know, I mean, there are people that are directly affected by this, and it is interesting, and it's a, you know, a discussion for another time, why that is that we don't see more of that in these towns where there's politicians pressuring, you know, these local business, you know, Rocky Wirtz and so on, and each and every town, pressuring these guys to, like, come on, like, what is this all about, and let's get something done, because it's hurting our local economy.
I think that's it's a great point, and in a smaller way than just having one, although in some respects it could happen like that, whereby you have one main business, so to speak, that employs a majority of the people in town. It's not like that in Chicago, obviously, but The facts are this, though, I think, from a political standpoint, you don't have the involvement because you really don't have, big cities don't have the ability to commit the money. I mean, you know, and from a player standpoint, the best thing that could happen to the players is they had some form of competition come in whereby they had a choice. You know, the WHA isn't going to roll out again. But I mean, if that could happen, that makes these talks altogether different. That makes the presence of a Don Fear altogether different. But there really is no opportunity to make the same money anywhere else. I mean, some of them could go to Europe and play. I mean, that's a for sure, some of them. But as you know, many of these players won't have that opportunity. The majority of them won't. And from a political standpoint, I mean, you know, you brought up the teacher strike. I mean, yeah, they got a raise. But at the end of the day, the person with the most money is going to win. And if it's the boss, it's the boss. And at some point, you know, there's going to be schools that close. There's going to be jobs that are lost. You know, thousands of jobs in the teacher strike case, you know, over the next few years. And in hockey, you just have to wonder if it's just kind of an evolutionary process in an economical sense, whereby, you know, they're going to try this time to make it more equitable so that more teams could survive. But if that doesn't happen, if the league doesn't flourish, if, you know, the media involvement, the TV coverage has never been better in a lot of respects, if they can't generate enough money whereby 30 teams are going to be able to prosper, or at least, let's put it this way, the majority of the teams are able to prosper, so that you could have a situation whereby, you know, the Pittsburgh Pirates, let's say, of baseball could play to empty fields most of the time and still wind up making $20 million a year. Well, in hockey, if the bottom rung of teams, you know, the bottom group of teams that don't have hope for the playoffs, at least if they could get out of the mess without losing big money and not gushing red ink, well, that leads to a stronger league overall. I don't know if we're going down the road that this is basically the last time that we're going to see something like this, and the next thing that could happen is jobs are going to be lost because, you know, there'll be some sort of a contraction. I don't know what else could be done. You have a league that basically doesn't have enough revenue, can't emulate the NFL socialism model in sports, which everyone tries to copy, but, you know, they have such a big base with so much money coming in that it makes it easier, obviously, for all teams to buy in. You don't have that in hockey. It's different. And like I say, it's more convoluted, too, because you have a couple of different countries, different currencies involved. And it's just a unique situation in a lot of respects, different than every other major sport in this country.
You know, one of the reasons why we are where we're at today, and you can blame the players in part for this, but it's the fallout of the previous CBA negotiations back in 2004-05, is the fact that the NHL's PA just couldn't get their act together. It took 6 years for them to get to Donald Fear, and there was a lot of distrust in the wake of what happened to the PA in that last negotiation. So one of the reasons why we're here today is because it took them so long to get to Donald Fear, to hire Donald Fear to represent them. But in sort of going back to a point that you made, I would ask you, Al, what could have been done in order to avoid this? What could have been done by both sides, or by maybe one side in particular, to avoid a long work stoppage like this?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes you wind up on third base and don't hit a triple. And if you look at what happened last time, and, you know, judging from people that were in the room, the big market teams cried at what went on. The, you know, the smaller market teams thought they would be helped by the salary cap. Basically, for the most part, the owners thought that even though the players got screwed in many respects, the owners thought that they were getting bent over. And, you know, this would be a more equitable way. The big market clubs didn't like the idea of having to support the weak sisters, yada, yada, yada. And what turned out, okay, after all the dissatisfaction from both sides, and really the CBA in many respects, in a lot of respects, looks like it was written over a long weekend rather than something that could have taken a year to progress to. But as you say, there were reasons for it. But many, there were big holes in it. But what happened? Just because of happenstance more than anything else, I mean, the U.S. economy hit the skids. The Canadian economy did rather well. The price of oil went up. Canadian economy, they export things that other countries wanted, oil being one of them. For a lot of different reasons, the dollar went south. The currency in Canada went up. And the strong teams in Canada basically helped carry the league. And, you know, and this isn't by any genius of Gary Bettman. I mean, it turned out that way. It turned out that way that there was going to be a Comcast NBC versus marriage, that all of a sudden now almost every night there's a game on TV, it seems like. A lot better media coverage. A lot of different things happened there that just kind of fell into place that basically a poor agreement to start with, in my view, one that wasn't that great, was placated. They just kept it going. And in so much as to say, the players were making more money than they had in the past. The league's revenues grew. So instead of stopping the last agreement when it was supposed to stop, they extended it, 2 years? And now you've come to the point where, you know, the realization hits that there were things that weren't right on both sides. But, I mean, all in all, if someone would have looked at it pragmatically and would have ignored the bottom line success of the league and focused more on the individual franchise inequities and things that really didn't make sense, I think that maybe this could have been worked out and not extended 2 more times. Maybe it could have been extended 1 more time, and then a Don Fehr came in, the players didn't get things together, and the owners just kind of went along with things. And now it almost is to the point where what I'm seeing on some of these issues that are supposedly key issues is a lot of this is owners protecting themselves from each other. You know, you have a Leopold that comes out and says, yeah, we have to keep salaries in line, and then he's bidding like a drunken sailor on, you know, the two most sought-after free agents this summer, and he signs both of them. So, I mean, there's so much that doesn't seem to make sense, and so many things that fell into place that basically made the last agreement and made the sport look like maybe it was a lot healthier in many respects than it was. And I think that human nature takes hold, and people just go along with what's there. And the players really didn't have a whole lot of desire, I think, to change the last CBA. You know, they let it go, too, because they were doing real well. They were making more money. So there wasn't really the focus until now. And now it's come to the point that the way it's set up, the numbers don't get put in till midsummer. I mean, people that thought this was going to end, you know, right away, I was hopeful that it would somehow end in the summer, something would come to a culmination whereby after a couple of weeks it would be done. But once that didn't happen, I didn't think that the players were coming back by December 1st. And now we've come to the 11th hour. This is it. If nothing comes to pass soon, there will be another missed season. So I don't know all the answers. I just know that going back from the last agreement, it wasn't as good as it could have been to start. But things worked out better for players and owners, many owners in the league as a whole, than maybe it should have. And maybe there was a reluctance to change things because of that on both sides.
In my view, this thing is dragged out as far as it did because back in July, Gary Bettman declared war on the PA when he came out with that first proposal, bringing the players' share from 57%, which it hasn't been. Just to be clear, the players haven't been getting 57% for the life of this deal. It was something that escalated because their percentage was tied to revenues. But they're at 57% or were at 57%, and he wanted to bring them down to 43%. The moment, and then all those other restrictions, five-year contracts, lowering the collective bargaining agreement, all of that. When he did that, he declared war on the PA. But I feel for Gary Bettman in a sense, okay. And I think there's a very important thing here to look at. And whenever the deal gets consummated, we see the details. It's very important, I think, for ownership, not for the players, but for ownership, that this is how we'll see how smart Gary is. Because this we're here now because the CBA ended on September 15th and not June 30th. That's why we're here. Because over the summer, all these players that are expiring deals, they all got paper. And whether they're making that money or not, some of them got signing bonuses that were paid on July 1st or whatever the date they signed their contract. But aside from that, while they're not getting money, they have contracts, and so they had some form of security. And the way that I feel for Gary, even though that was another short-sighted move of his when he got that deal that he thought was perfect for his league back in 2005. But the way I feel sorry for him is because he had all these owners, whether it's the big market teams that are mad that they, in hindsight, looking back on it, that they didn't take the PA's last proposal in February of 2005 that wasn't tied to revenues, that cost the owners $1 billion, which, don't kid yourself, that's why we're here, another reason. But I feel for Gary because he had all these owners, the lower market teams saying we can't turn a profit, the big market teams saying there's not enough money going into our pockets. Whatever the individual owner's reason for it, he had all these owners going to him and say, fix this, Gary. But then he had all those owners going out and, pardon the expression, fucking him over the off season by giving out all those ridiculous contracts. The owners knew that Gary was going to ask for five-year term limits, and they went out and gave all these deals. They gave the players the foundation to sit on and say, no, we're not accepting this 43%, which they were never going to. The 43% was it was a basis to sell the perception that the league was making concessions as they moved up to a 50-50. That's what that was. But still, it laid the groundwork for the PA to stand back and say, this is ridiculous, and we're unified and we're together in this fight.
I agree with you on the point that it can't, if this happens again, and it'll happen again, most likely, if it happens again, you can't start the clock ticking on September 15th. I agree with that. I think the revenue split, it was a ludicrous offer to begin with. But if you remember, and if you followed it, as I know you have, more than most, more than I have, to detail, they got to 50-50 pretty quickly. But, the make-whole provision, this and that, the variance thing, which is kind of sketchy to me to begin with, the term limit is a big deal. And I think that they're moving back towards, I think, maybe that could get tweaked to 7-8 or 6-8 or something like that. But if you change the term limit and you only have a five-year term limit and the variance only goes to 10%, the paradigm of pay structure in the NHL is going to change drastically. It becomes a more of a have and a have not with players, maybe just as much as it is with owners now, maybe more so. I mean, if it's going to go to $60 million next year, not this year, but the following year, I mean, you look at it, the Hawks have basically six players that account for, close to $30 million, close to half of that money. Six players from a cap hit standpoint. So I think that maybe like it is in a lot of respects with everything, it seems like, in this country over the last few years or most things, I mean, the players might just have to realize that they're going to make less as a group until things catch up and until there's more revenue to spread around, and maybe that happens. Maybe the popularity of the sport increases as it has been, and seemingly to me, and the pot just gets bigger. But, you know, the 50-50, the revenue split, the make-whole provision, if you're still going to limit the terms, and although they've relaxed that up enough so that teams could keep their cores together now, keep their own players, and even if they go to 6 years, 6 years isn't that great. That makes a difference on free agent signings, no doubt. And the variance, as you've brought up with me in some conversations, you know, that's a big deal too. And that's one I don't understand completely. If I'm an owner, I want to dictate how I pay someone. If it stays the same, whereby if it's a $20 million contract and it's a 5-year deal, it's a $4 million cap hit for the 5 years. I want to be able to say, you know what, in year one, I want that player to make $8 million just because of other factors involved in my business. If, to me, the most equitable thing to do, which helps the weak sister teams in some respects too, maybe, to compete, is instead of making it a variance between years and what seemed to be a point of contention with the last CBA, which could have been corrected with about two sentences included in it, concerning the amount of money that a player makes in the last few years of a long contract. If you're going to sign someone to a 10-year contract, let's say, or a 9-year contract, let's say, the last 3 years, the last third of the contract, he should be paid out at least 20% of his overall salary. That way, you get away from all of the, well, it's a retirement contract, he's going to walk away, whatever else. That could have been done. But now with the variance, now you're limiting basically what teams are going to be able to pay, because you can't fix the cap, so to speak, and leverage yourself and stretch out term. And that's going to make a big difference for the whole pay structure involved with the players now. And I think although the players have gotten more than they seem to be able, were going to be able to get a few months ago, that still is a big deal. And it's still going to change the dynamics of the sport moving forward, I think.
I don't understand why, you know, it's like, okay, you've got the 50-50 from the owner's perspective. You got your 50-50. You're going to get some sort of a cap on the amount of years you can give a player. Why is it the owners insist on having a say in how the players divide their percentage? I don't get that. And the one thing that I think, and they're moving off of they've moved to 10% on the variance. One of the things I don't understand from Donald Fear's perspective is why he started his argument on variance at 25%. I think that that's where it should be. You know, there's no transparency in the NHL. It's like, oh, the variance is to prevent front-loaded contracts or back diving, you know, or these retirement contracts. That's bogus. If you wanted to prevent those things, if you wanted to prevent a guy from making $12 million in year one and $500,000 in year 12, well, how do you prevent that?
You take the mark per year.
Yeah, what's your cap hit? It's your salary. You know, I mean,
that's right. That's the ultimate way. Exactly right. But explain to me why my way doesn't ever get brought up. The last third of the contract should be a certain percentage of the money. Okay, so that stops you from completely front end loading it. It stops any kind of inference that a guy's going to walk away after year 8 or whatever. He'd be leaving 20% of his total contract on the table rather than go from $10 million or $8 million a year down to 5, down to 2, 1, 1, 1, or whatever it is, like even the Hossa deal. I mean, I don't understand why that can't be done, and who does that hurt if it were to be done that way? I don't understand. I mean, I guess I look at the world a little bit differently. I mean, from a business standpoint, why can't it be done that way?
Well, if you're looking at this as a Blackhawks fan, you're like, how would this affect my team? what's going to happen if player free agency isn't going to change? Players are going to go to free agency, and they're going to get top dollar because this system is set up where the best players, the players that are the best players and who drive revenue. And you could make the argument that this is the way it should be, and you'd have a good argument that the Patrick Kanes, the Sidney Crosbys, the Brad Richards, those are the players that deserve the most money because those are the players that the fans pay to see. You can make that argument, and that's fine. And the players should fight to keep as much as they can. But the problem here is those players are always going to go to free agency. There's always going to be the demand, and they're always going to get top dollar. That's not going to change. What's going to change is Stan Bowman's not going to have the flexibility to get a player. You know, just like you said, it's like for whatever reason, if I have $10 million in cap space in year one, but I only have four in year two, but I want this player desperately, and he wants to come here, and I want to win a championship with this player. Well, guess what? If you've got that 10% variance and you only have $4 million in cap space you project in year two, you're not going to get that player, Blackhawks fans. So what then is going to happen? What does Stan Bowman have to do to prepare for that situation every year? He's going to have a bunch of players on 1 and 2 year deals with expiring contracts. You're going to have general league wide now. You're going to have general managers that are going to make decisions, unless of course the NHL decides that their trade deadline is going to be in late March, which I don't see happening. You're going to have general managers making decisions far earlier than they ever have before on whether they're in the playoffs or they're not in the playoffs. Because in order to be a player in free agency, which because you can't be creative, is going to be a straight-up bidding war on players. It's going to be a free auction. You're going to have general managers that are going to have to dump out of the playoffs early and sell off deals because they want to be a player in a certain auction for a player. I don't know that it's in the best interest of the game to have that environment.
Well, now you're bringing up another factor, which I won't disagree with either, the best interest of the game. I think, unless I'm missing something, and I seem to look at this a little bit differently because I don't see a lot of other people really concerned with it, if the purpose of a union, and although this isn't a true union in the sense of a labor union in my view, if the purpose of the union is to protect jobs and to provide the most utility, the most good for the membership as a whole, what's going to happen here is a lot of players that were getting 3 and 4 year deals, they're not going to get those deals. I mean, if it goes to 6 years, your top tick players will get the 6 years. And then because of the way it's structured, the way things are going to be structured, like you just alluded to and you said, there are going to be a lot of players on 1 and 2 year deals, which a lot of those players now are making $2 million, $2.5 million on 3 year deals. They're going to make $1.5 million on 1 year deals, or maybe $3.5 million on 2 year deals. They're going to make less money. I mean, that's overall, I mean, you go to 50-50, whatever other way you want to cut it, I mean, the paradigm is going to change on how they could pay players. And I think going from $70 million to $60 million in 1 year is kind of crazy. I mean, I'd be looking to maybe stretch that out somehow. But if you go from $70 million to $60 million in 1 year, you've got Kane, Tave, Sharp, Hossa, Seabrook, and Keith making, what, close to $30 million cap hit-wise. So now that gives you six players. So if you're going by 23, that leaves another 17 players for $30 million, right? So, and like I say, also the variance part, I don't understand that. I don't see it from either side. I don't see it from the owner's side, except for the fact that maybe we've come to the point where the voices of those who don't make money and own teams in the NHL is now stronger than the 6 or 8 or 9 or 10, however you want to calculate, big market teams. And like you say, Bettman's in a position where, you know, he has to serve every master. And now some of these And now some of these things seem like seem as if they're more or less the voices of the have-nots trying to bend the rules and to make things more equitable for them moving forward from a pay structure standpoint.
Yeah, you know, I want to say, because the variance to me from the very beginning, and it's funny that this has been an issue that hasn't really come up or really been focused on until of late, from the NHL's first proposal, the variance issue to me is huge, because as you say, and this is why I'm the only thing that's really puzzled me about Donald Fehr, and I know there's a lot of things that puzzle you about Donald Fehr, but the only thing that's really puzzled me about his approach to this is not being more actively opposed to that variance, because that variance changes everything. Like as a point I just made, it will, you have your haves and you have nots, but it also reduces the lifespan of a hockey player, because if you've got guys on 1 and 2 year deals, they're, you know, you don't have guys that have 4 year contracts that, okay, well, maybe they're evaluated in Chicago and they move along to Florida or Winnipeg or wherever, okay, but they still have deals. Well, if you've got a guy's on 1 and 2 year deals, not only are they being evaluated, like hockey scouting departments are going to grow, because not only are they being evaluated by Chicago, they're being evaluated by the entire league every single year. So, and what's the nature of a hockey scout? What's the nature of what we do? It's to pick apart and to criticize. So when these guys are coming up annually every single year, every 2 years, they're going to be picked apart and they're going to be tossed aside, and prospects are going to be overvalued. That's just the nature of what's going to go on. So for that 25% variance, which is going to eliminate the middle class, which is going to eliminate the middle class contract, the guys are going to have shorter term careers. And I don't understand that from the PA's perspective, why they haven't attacked that more. To me, it's the crux of the whole stand, it should be, on the PA's part. Okay, we're going to have to do 50-50 because the NBA did 50-50. We'll have to bite the bullet on some of these other things. But absolutely, under no circumstances, if I'm a part of that PA, should that variance be anything less than 25%? Number one, because of what I just said. And number two is, why are the owners dictating how we as the players divide what is our share?
Yeah, I can't speak to the fact about the players and their share and this and that, but from the standpoint of how players are going to get paid, if you limit the amount that the contract can move from 1 year to the next, it could vary from 1 year to the next, that in essence, how are you going to give someone a $72 million contract like Marian Hossa got? I mean, if one player can't account for more than, what is it now, 20%? Of the cap?
Yeah.
Isn't that it? I mean, if that stays the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so in essence, what all this does, in a kind of a slight-handed way, it's just not focused on, if you want to reduce term limit, which they made a sticking point and jumps off the page of people, and plus the variance part of it on how, you know, you could structure the contracts as far as salary-wise and everything else, I mean, basically what's happening is that, in essence, players are going to make, there's going to be less commitment to individual player contracts dollar-wise, which affects everyone. And if hockey's always been judged, I mean, even going back when Dennis Savard made $250,000 and he was the top tick with the Blackhawks, that seems to be the way hockey is basically slotted internally with franchises. Okay, he's my best player at $6 million. I can't do without him. We go down from there. And once you get past the top six players or five players or whatever that number is that you deem as your core, there's not going to be a whole lot left. And there's only so much that could be done with it. So the majority of players are going to make less money, and as you say, maybe have shorter careers because of it too. So it's like the teachers union. Okay, we got our raise, not as much as we wanted, but we got a raise. But over the next 3 years, there's thousands of jobs lost and schools closing. So I mean, what was accomplished from a union standpoint in that respect. What's accomplished this time, except to say that the game has to work, the sport has to work from a financial and economic point for every owner if there's going to be 30 teams. And it seems to me that the way that things are moving, and sometimes it's in a more subtle way, basically players are going to make overall less money. There's going to be less capital commitment towards player salaries with less liability for ownership. I mean, I don't know, maybe players will get to the point where a lot of them don't even use agents. You're almost going to be slotted. There isn't a whole lot to be talked about, you know, stretching out contracts, looking for this, looking for that, incentive bonuses and everything else. It's going to be basically kind of a black and white, you're slotted here, this is what it is, you know, you've done well, you get a 3-year deal, you're in a group that only gets a 1-year deal, which is going to be, you know, which could be in some respects a third of the team.
Well, I mean, I want to move along, but I disagree with that. I think in this system, I think agents will be more important than ever. You know, if you've got a deal coming up every single year, every 2 years for the most part, I think agents will be more important than ever. And even to the top guys that are going to have, you know, 10 to 15 teams looking at them every summer, and again, you know, in basically a free bidding auction war, I think agents will be more important than ever. But I want to move along because I think – one of the things that when we talk about, like, why is the NHL, you know, why are they so insistent on putting a cap on contract? You know, to me, Al, and maybe you disagree with this, I don't know, we haven't talked about this, but the elephant in the room here that's really, you know, because, you know, you have these players going over and playing in Europe, these players that have, they're locked out, but they have NHL contracts and they want to go over and just play hockey and not get out of shape. But like a lot of players learned, and Blackhawks fans would know this, Adrian Ikoyi, Nikolai Ovechkin, and so on and so on. Players who learned that they didn't play during the last lockout, in some respects, were never the same. So you have a lot of players going over there, and what was the key issue in a lot of these guys' circumstances is the issue of insurance. Al, the elephant in the room here that no one wants to talk about, I guess, is player insurance. And when we talk, when Gary Bettman talks about the rising costs of NHL teams doing business, and why is that? It's because player insurance is going up. You know, it's hard to get and maintain an insurance premium on Marian Hossa's contract when Rafi Torres puts a hole in his head. And, you know, so that's something that is, you know, insurance costs are going up and up. And it's hard to get insurance on these contracts for owners, and to me, and the reason for it, Al, and you know, this is a hockey society issue. No one wants to make the game any safer. Everyone will give lip service to say, "Oh, concussions are terrible. They need to do something about concussions." But as soon as a guy is ready, like the Blackhawks were very aggravated with Jeremy Morin, and there's been other guys that sat out forever and ever with concussions because they, as soon as they think you're ready, they want you back in that lineup because you're an asset. But no one wants to make – you're going to give lip service to it, but no one really wants to make the game safer. No one wants to take fighting out of the game. That's an insurance issue. No one wants to take – you'll say you want to take headshots out of the game. You'll try to take headshots out of the game, but you're really not taking headshots out of the game. That raises insurance. So the fact, the simple fact, the state of doing business for the NHL, and it's why it's like term on contract limits as far as the number of years, it's not something that I've really bothered to argue with the NHL on, is because just how hard it is to insure these contracts now because of the elephant in the room, which is player safety, which is going unaddressed because the NHL is fearful if they take some of those things out of the game that they're going to lose fans.
Well, the losing fans part, that's an interesting way to look at it. And I think it's more or less, in my view, no one wants to assume liability. No one wants to admit the game isn't safe because there's a liability factor involved there, although obviously there is a liability factor involved. So what's ultimately going to happen this time around is if you don't have to sign a Marian Hossa to a I don't know, what did he sign the last time? And the contract goes out till, I don't know, another, I don't know how many years. But if you don't sign players to 10 or 12-year contracts, that reduces your liability. the liability is only for 6 years. So maybe that's the way they're looking at it. And you brought up another factor, too. I mean, that's different than a lot of other sports. Hockey's a very expensive sport to run. I mean, the cost, the expenses involved are I mean, they're heavy duty. I heard Brian Burke a few years ago say that he thought the Maple Leafs would spend $600,000 on sticks. And, you know, I don't think that's an out-of-line estimate. And it might be more than that, for all I know. And if it's less, it isn't much less, probably. I mean, and if you just look at the amount of money it costs to have an NHL team, I mean, all these things weigh upon the sport. So as far as making it more safe with regards to concussions, until the NHL has some sort of a system in place whereby the team doctors aren't involved as much as they are, deeming a player fit to play. And this is no disrespect to any team doctor or anything else. I think we all have heard enough stories of how the system is gamed, how players answer the way they think the doctor wants to hear the answer in so many different respects. I mean, we've heard that from NHL players. That's just not my opinion. And I think that it's easier for that stuff to happen when you have a familiarity with a doctor who you're always around and knows you as a hockey player and also as a person. But once again, though, hockey's played 3 or 4 times a week. It's not like the NFL that's just kind of going to that system or has in the last year or so, I think, whereby there are certain doctors that perform those tests and it's kind of regimented by the league. You know, hockey's different. The logistics aren't there for that to happen, I guess, right away. And it's a money thing, too. You'd have to have different teams of doctors and in different sections of the country. And it gets involved because of so many games going on at so many different times and so many different places. But when you look at it, I mean, that's something that should happen. You know, some players go into a dark room when they get clobbered. Marcus Kruger gets his bell rung, it looks to me, like every other game, and, you know, he goes to the bench and puts his head down and comes back on the ice, and then sometimes he doesn't show up the next period, and then he's out for 2 weeks with a concussion. And so it's all scattered.
Yeah, that you brought up that Brian Burke, $600,000 on sticks a season. That's a real number. That comes out to a little bit less than or about 100 sticks per player every season, which is a real number.
Which is feasible, yeah.
Yeah, so that $600,000 on sticks is a real number. Yeah. I guess when you look at from Gary's side and from Don's side, start with Don, because you know you have issues with how he's approached this. What are the areas that you've seen that you feel that he's misstepped, and maybe an area or two where you think like that Don has done well in these negotiations?
Well, I think I'll start with what he's done well with. I think he's going to end up doing, if this ends now, okay, I think he's going to probably end up doing, you know, close to what he could have done for the players. But I think that where he postures with things and drags his feet, and to me, there should have been more awareness. I think the edge that the players had was they needed the public to be on their side. And that had to start a long time ago. And there needed to be more communication by him, more openness, more public awareness. You know, come right out and say, we need the 50-50. This is what we're willing to give. In essence, I think he had to operate, being fear, from a subordinate position, which he's in. I mean, and no matter what, if we're going to drag our feet and take this out to the 11th hour or maybe miss an entire year, if we miss an entire year, it could go spill over into the next year. And then at the end of the day, everyone loses for sure because the sport's going to take a step back or two, if not more. So I don't see where time was on his side. I know that you just can't rush and grab the first, you know, the first volley from the owners, and they had things worked out, but it almost seemed like fear reacted and was led around in this. And my disappointment with him is you know, even the decertification stuff, that could have been all in place. I think the NFL did that almost a year ahead of time, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, that could have been all in place. Lay that out there, that's a possibility right from the beginning. You know, go into this thinking that every day that's lost is money a player is never going to get back. And I don't feel that that was basically what he did. And maybe I'm wrong, not privy to everything. I guess my dissatisfaction with him more than yours is I expected more. I expected a different way of going about things. I expected a different manner of approach to start with. And I think at the end of the day, you know, if this ends now, we're going to say, okay, almost half the season is lost. That's millions of dollars out of the players' pockets. Upset fans, which for the most part are going to come back, I think, like the last time, or maybe even more so because it's only half a year we're missing. But I think we're going to sit here and we're probably going to agree, what was really the point of all this that took 40 games or so to miss, or 30, 35 games, or whatever it turns out to be, 34 games? What was really accomplished that needed to take this long?
Well, to me, I think, and I'll answer that from my perspective, I think the point of this is the way that Gary and the owners approached this and Prosco Rose approached this was to accomplish what they did 8 years ago, which was break the union, to get what they wanted. So to me, you know, you could have filed for decertification or a disclaimer of interest in July, but what purpose, why did they even need Donald Sphere to do that? You know, what
right.
purpose did that serve? But once it became clear what the owner's mission was, then it's you know, and I said this in September, you know, it's when people are like, when is this thing going to end? What, you know, it's going to take time because what the players have to do, what Donald Fear's job now is to keep the union together. And, you know, what this is now is, yes, it's an ultimate game of chicken. Because it's Don's trying to get the best deal he can for the players now that Gary and Bill Daly and Prosco Rose, Bob Batterman are actually negotiating, apparently. Okay, it's his job to get the best deal he can for the players. But and this is going to go into a question I want to ask you. But to me, if this season's canceled, the players have to decertify at some point because of the way that sports labor unions are going. At one of these next negotiations, one of these next two or three negotiations, is going to be, because in regular labor unions, most often than not, although Chicago Public School Teachers, because half of the union is not guaranteed a job after year two of that deal, maybe that's the exception. But in most unions, unions fight to improve working conditions, and, you know, don't make the argument all these guys are millionaires, but the Players Association and the NHL and in other unions are constantly being chipped away at, having things taken away from them. So where this whole thing is going in the grand scheme is that, yes, player associations are going to be a thing of the past here pretty soon. So it's Gary Bettman, the owners, have to ask themselves, do they want to be the one that dissolved the first union when it's been Prosper Rose's brilliant strategy, for the most part, that they've used the unions against themselves? Because if the players decertify, that's it, Al. Salary cap is gone. You know, the entire framework that the NHL's economy is built on is gone. And I think if that happens, the NHL will be bankrupt in 2 years. Because this is, Al, and I want to ask you this question. This lockout is a war on general managers and agents, more so than it is players. And, you know, Gary Bettman has, you know, he has this thing where he only needs eight owners on his side to cancel this season. He only needs the vote of eight owners, if he wants to cancel the season. What are the odds that he cancels this season in your mind?
Well, right now I would say not. They're not very high. Now, if we're having this discussion next Monday, the same discussion, I would say that it's pretty high. This is a crucial week. The question I think that's ultimately we're going to find out are the majority of players better off with a union, and will it be in existence for the next 5 years? Or are they better off without a union, whereby And your statement about the league going broke, I don't think that's going to happen, going bankrupt. I think that the league as we know it will be far different. But in a union situation, and here's where the kind of the paradox is, there's no choice for these players. There's no choice. I always thought in the back of my mind that someday a group of wealthy players who have retired in the last few years, you know, could get together with some big money people, and at some point in time there could be some sort of another WHA, if you will, maybe an 8 or 10 team league that could come up and possibly be like a competition type of deal with the NHL, rather than think about expansion. Maybe it would happen after the league kind of contracts or something like that. But there's no place even to play. And unless you were to go into certain cities, even in Chicago, I mean, you'd have to go out to Allstate, and there's the skyboxes and stuff. Unless you were really going to have a pared-down payroll, the numbers don't work to have any competitive kind of force there in place whereby players have a choice. So ultimately, Fear's got, yeah, it's a union, but where's the stopgap for him? At what point does it make sense to fight? I mean, players, and as you said, if the job of the union is to protect the most jobs, well, you know, even if this deal that we're seeing now is signed, you're going to have the same amount of jobs, but those jobs are going to pay less. So I guess, you know, it's not just semantics. I guess it's the way to look at the world. It's a different type of formula involved here. And I don't know if a pure union works in this environment because it isn't like, you know, it isn't like you have the United Auto Workers and they strike and then there's no more cars and society is dependent upon that. Let's just say, for example, it's a stretch. I mean, if there's no more hockey, some people are going to care a lot, but the world's going to keep spinning. And ultimately, the players are in a position now where I think they should realize, and if they don't realize now, they will soon, that they're probably going to make less money going forward as a whole. Not every player is going to make less money, but as a group, they are, until things improve to a certain point whereby there's enough revenue to spread around.
I just wish that, you know, that's, if I'm a player, if I'm Donald Fear, I can accept that if Gary Bettman and Bill Daly and all of those parties do a better job of explaining, and for the fans that are sitting here in disbelief as to why is a league that reports record-breaking revenues every single
yes.
year in the past 3 years, why is it that they need to take away from the players and put all these restrictions? Why? Just give us some sort of an explanation why this needs to happen. It's sort of these veiled references to rising costs. Oh, jet fuel costs more, so we have to cancel half of the season to purge the players. Why? Give us a better explanation why. And to me, and it's not like you have to take us into the negotiations. It's not like you have to open up NHL Network and bring cameras into the room. Just explain to us why. So while we're sitting here, we can feel better about this. You know, it's getting to the point. And I just had this conversation with someone the other day, and I, you know, I, maybe I'm the wrong person to really take, you know, sort of take the temperature of, because I still, whether there's NHL or not, I'm going to watch hockey, and whether there's NHL or not, I'm going to cover hockey. I'm just different. But I'm almost to the point now where I'm getting to a point where, you know what, if the NHL doesn't come back this year, it's really not going to affect me at all. It's like I was sitting around the other day, I was looking at my schedule, and I'm just like, geez, you know, if the Blackhawks come back, like, how am I even going to do this? You know, like, how am I even going to go to all these games? I've adapted to life without the NHL, and it's like if NHL comes back, it's like, yeah, I'll be excited. Yeah, it'll be great to go to games. But it's almost to the point now where you've adjusted your life, and it's almost going to be an encumbrance on, you know, how do you make this work?
And hockey's a much bigger part of your life than it is 99 9/10 of the people in the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and here's my disappointment. And you brought up valid points. if this was a normal business, if this was the corporate world, and we saw this going on, and a company had record earnings for the last 3 years, never made more money, and then all of a sudden they said, okay, now we have to cut the player's share by 7%, or actually it's close to, well, whatever it was, 57 to 50, however you want to chop the numbers up. We want to cut their percentage of revenue split. We want to put caps on this, caps on that. You'd be looking at, well, what's going on here? What's wrong? I mean, you know, this is America. We all make more money together, don't we? Well, the fact of the matter is that it's so convoluted. This is a revenue-based salary cap on a team, on a league whereby most teams don't make money. That always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. But once again, I keep thinking I'm looking at things the wrong way in some respects, because didn't seem to bother anybody else, or didn't bother most people. There was so much emphasis put on overall revenues controlling salary cap, this and that, and there wasn't enough attention paid to profitability. Now, if teams are fudging their books that much, which I don't think they are, from the standpoint that overall you want your franchise to be worth more money so that someday it could be sold for more money, and if it's constantly bleeding red ink, it's not going to be sold for as much money as it could be sold. Now, there are different situations when, you know, subsidiary companies, this and that. But for the most part, but your point is exactly correct. My dissatisfaction with the Donald Fear is I don't expect Gary Bettman to do that. I don't expect 30 owners to open their books and to do this and to do that and to try to save face. As a collective group, they may, but individually, they're not going to do that unless they had to. I expected representation from the players' part to bring that to the forefront from the beginning. Back in the summer, even before the Stanley Cup was won, that had to be talked about. There had to be more media attention focused on that. There had to be more education of the public. There had to be more things involved than there were, so that this could move off of the crazy starting point that it had and the late start that it has because of just the way the structure is concerning when contracts are in place and when the last CBA expired. All of that seemed to be something that Donald Fear, for whatever reason, and as you say, even now, some of these things that he doesn't seem to be making a point of, at least in public, they're head scratchers to me. So I don't know. I think if this year is lost completely, the odds of next year being lost go way up again, because unless this is all going to be reworked and basically started from ground zero and starting today or tomorrow, whenever the whistle blows and Gary Bettman were to cancel the season, work has to start from the next day forward. You can't wait 6-8 months to get things going again, or 5 months or 4 months either. So to me, the odds of losing the next year go way up. And if that happens, the people that are going to care less is going to grow greatly. And as it is now, I think some people have more or less resolved themselves to the fact that if it happens, great. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. And you've said it yourself. You fill your time with other things, and you, like I, will watch other forms of hockey.
Well, you know, and I think, to me, you know, will a deal get done? Yes, I absolutely do think there will be a deal that's going to get done, because I think, number one, there aren't enough owners losing significant money to cancel an entire season. I think the damage, everybody understands that the damage that will be done to the league will in some ways be irreparable. But I also do believe that while the owners are upset and they want to put more money back in their pockets, that they feel that they just handed over to the players due to, in hindsight, missteps with the last CBA. I think the bigger picture here is that the owners don't want to be the group that sends the players into a real decertification and losing their salary cap. I just think that would be too devastating. And if we go down that road, Al, if the players decertify, I don't know how, because it'll be challenged in the court, because, again, the owners don't want to lose their salary cap. So that means that they'll have to fight it in court. They've already put step one. They claim that decertification will be a sham. So that'll be argued in court. The court system doesn't move at the NHL's wants and needs. So we're not going to have hockey next October if that's the road this goes down. I just think that everybody realizes that that's an enormous mess.
It's an enormous mess, and chances are, if there is hockey again, it may not be with 30 teams in the league.
Right. So I can't say it with 100% resolve, but 95 to 98% resolve that this thing's going to end, and we're going to have hockey. And I to the point that I made, Gary Bettman needs 8 owners to say no deal, and he can say no deal. But I truly believe that if Gary Bettman has 22 owners saying make this happen, and he has 8 saying no, cancel the season, he ain't canceling the season because he'll be out of work the next day.
He's not going to get, and to be frank with you, not to interrupt, but he's not going to get 8 owners to cancel the season because the word would get out who those 8 owners were, and that's suicide. So I don't think that's going to happen in that respect.
I just want to bring that up because I think that's something that...
Right, it's a good point to bring
time.
Up.
Yeah.
Right, it's a good point to bring up. I think the sway is starting to become that middle group. Not the 8 that make a lot of that make good money or the 8 that get killed. It's that middle group of teams that, you know, could sniff a little bit of money, that think they have things going their way, that have some control over their expenses. That's where probably the strength lies, and maybe a lot of this stuff is coming from their voices, you know, which probably accounts to, I don't know, you know, it depends on how you want to keep track, maybe close to half the league or better or a little bit more. I just wish they'd get done with this. And I mean, I've always been more of a player person. I think they've been taken advantage of over time, you know, going back. But I mean, now when you look at it, I mean, I think, you know, they make a fine living. I think they have to realize that the world's changing and try to situate themselves not only with their own best interest in mind, but I think they have to look at it from the standpoint that the best interest for the most players possible is to have the most teams possible and to have this thing work the way it is structured now. So there's a fine line, and it certainly is convoluted, but hopefully, you know, hopefully this will be over and we can start focusing on who's going to be on the Blackhawk roster to start the year, and we could be talking about hockey in a couple of weeks.
So that being said, as we move towards a wrap-up here, what is it going to take to get this deal done? A lot of people are saying 10 days. That's to make the 48-game season. Obviously, that's preferable. I think the real number and a drop-dead date is a 42-game season. But that being said, 10 days, what gets this deal done?
I think that takes us back to the things that we spoke about that doesn't seem to be front and center. I think, you know, they're at what now, 6-8 for term limit? If I'm Donald Fehr, I think I'd want to go 7-8. So, you know, or 7-9 or something close. But, I mean, every year is a big deal. So I think maybe he tries to tweak that. The 50-50, the make whole, no contract rollbacks. That's going to cripple some clubs in some respects, you know, but that's okay. I mean, they signed the deals. I think the variance is probably, you know, underneath it all, an interesting sticking point. And like you, you know, I'm thinking that he's not going to get anywhere close to 20%. I'm thinking that he's going to only tweak it up a little bit from where it is because it hasn't really been brought up as being a sticking point. So I don't know how he goes and asks for 25% or 20% unless, you know, but like I say, we're not in those meetings. I mean, maybe somehow he squeezes a few more percentage points out of it, but that's going to change the whole structure. That's going to change the paradigm. So
yeah, I don't. That's why I said I don't understand why he started at 25 because that means he's going to end up at 15. You know, if he gets to 15. I mean,
if he gets to 15, right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he might get to 15. Yeah, he might get to 15, I think. But, you know, but even at 15.
Yeah,
it's a big difference.
10, 15, it doesn't really change the dynamic. The dynamic is the same, but it does gives you a little bit more wiggle room, but not significant enough that it's not going to do what we talked about before.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I was looking for a little more creativity, like trade that off, okay,
and get rid of the floor.
That's an important thing to me, you know, because that's what, you know, teams like Florida, I mean, that floor really, if you really want to point at one thing, and then that's impossible, but for the sake of the argument, that floor and what you saw just most recently Florida having to do, it's like people were aghast at some of the contracts that Dale Talon gave out. Well, yeah, but Dale Talon, first of all, he had to find someone that was willing to come to Florida, and then once he found him, he had to overpay him because he had to get to the floor. And
see,
that throws off the entire economic balance of the league off.
Exactly, and if I'm Donald Fehr, I look at that and say, okay, if we want 30 teams to exist and we want to have 600-plus jobs, when you really look at it, the floor to me, and once again, I look at this differently because I don't see many other people bringing this up, made little sense. If a team is going to spend $20 or $30 million only on a salary, on their salary dedicated to salary expense, they're going to eliminate themselves unless they're masterful at drafting. And this isn't the MLB whereby you could develop talent, pay them for 3 years, and then ship them off somewhere, a la the Pittsburgh Pirates or some other teams, and still exist and make money. So the economics of the sport would basically cripple those clubs because they would always be losing because this is a gate-driven sport for the most part still, and they wouldn't be able to draw. So to me, that floor, all that does is get a lot of players, and I can understand why the union would want to keep it in some respects, but that would be something that I'd use as a chip to trade off for variance or maybe to extend term limit. Get rid of that floor. You have a lot of guys making, you know, $3.5 million a year that should be making $1.5 million or $1.8 million. And just for the credibility of the sport, this bottoming out where you just pitch every contract aside, trade your team away every year at the deadline until you get down to bare bones. And some people could say, well, that's what made the Blackhawks. And in some respects, it kind of did. They bottomed out too, and they got lucky with two low round draft picks that turned out to be studs and played right away. But I mean, when you look at it, I'd get rid of the floor and I'd use that as a leverage chip and make the points. The owners know that inflates salaries on a lot of players, a big group of players. But at least you'd have more teams with a chance of making money than they do now, I think, and there'd be more credibility for the sport overall. Use it as a bargaining chip and extend the variance, extend maybe the term limits. But like I say, I look at things different because things that strike me as being important, I don't hear anyone else talk about.
Yeah, you know, and again, that lower limit's still in there. And the December 27th proposal, that lower limit, it doesn't give numbers, but it's still in there. And, I agree with you on that. I think the other things that could make this deal happen tomorrow is the owners just say, from a player's perspective, why on these buyouts? Because owners like Sam or general managers like Sam Bowman are going to have to get under that salary cap next season. That's half a season away now. And if you've got to get from 70 or 72 down to under 60, you're going to have to buy guys out. And if I'm a player, it's like, okay, the reason why these other players are being bought out is because general managers and owners made mistakes. Why are we having to pay for those mistakes? And, you know, the owners, the league wants to get down to a $60 million cap. These owners, you know, want to get rid of these contracts. Bite the bullet. Why do we as players have to, you know, I think that there should be a number, whether it's two contracts or there should be a number that says you can do one or two buyouts and those count outside the system and anything more than that counts against there's got to be some sort of give on the league side on that, because again, that doesn't make sense from the union perspective. Why do we have to pay for mistakes that the owners make?
Yeah, and I agree too. There has to be some forgiveness. I mean, in a normal business, you make a mistake, you try to eliminate it. Well, here, you know, and people say, well, how come they didn't buy out Rusty Olish, and how come they didn't do this? And buyouts seldom happen or happen as infrequently as they do is because of the way it's structured with double the term on the payout and the back end and all of that. And the bottom line is GMs, that's the last resort because they don't want to look at that mistake on their books for twice as many years. So it doesn't happen. But I mean, if like you say, if you're going all the way down to 60 million, which I think that probably is something that has to be tweaked up. You know, I mean, that's a big drop from 70 to 60. And, it, you know, looking at CapGeek now, you know, if you look at the 2013-2014 numbers on the Hawks, it looks like their payroll is like at a little under 61 million, but that's without including six players that are under contract now that are on the roster. So there has to be some give, you know, and I mean, I don't know. You know, people have said, well, the Hawks have set themselves up. I don't believe in that setting yourself up. Last year was a time to go after someone down the stretch. It was as wide open as it could be. I mean, you saw who was in the Stanley Cup and who won. But, you know, they're not going to have to purge as many contracts as some teams or as many big-name players, but they're certainly going to have to come to a decisive conclusion as to if they're going to keep, you know, the six players I mentioned earlier, Kainte, Sharp, Hossa, Seabrook, Keith, and then to a lesser extent, Bolin's a UFA the following year. Are you going to keep this core together? And if you do that, and the salary cap is $60 million, can you pay a Johnny Oduya over $3 million if he's not a top four defenseman? You know, that's what I'm saying. With a lot of this, you know, it doesn't seem like much when you talk to these numbers, but the whole pay structure is going to change. You know, it just is. So interesting times ahead for sure. And I don't understand why that has to drop $10 million in 1 year. But like I say, I'm looking at things from a different standpoint and missing the pitch here, I guess, because I don't even hear about that being talked about as being changed. I would think you'd want it to go down that much over a couple, 3 years maybe.
It'll be interesting times, sure, for sure ahead. Again, I believe, I mean, there's very little doubt in my mind that this thing's going to end in the next 14 days, and we're going to be having hockey by the end of January. It's just a shame that it had to go this route, but it's not a surprise to me at all. And, you know, it's followed the script, Al. I mean, no matter the frustrations or what have you, it's followed the script. I mean, it's where we pretty much figured it would be today if we were looking at it objectively from the beginning.
Yeah, I think you and I were on the same page with that. I think both of us, you know, really doubted the season would start on time. I was more hopeful in the beginning that something, you know, would revolutionary would happen. But once it didn't, you know, I didn't buy into starting December 1st. And now we've gone, you know, just like the fiscal cliff stuff did last night. You know, we're going down to the last, basically, almost to the end of when they could get a 48-game season. And you may be right ultimately, Chris, if some of this really comes about and there's some significant changes in the next day or two that come about, maybe it'll only be a 42-game schedule. But I think that, you know, despite what a lot of people think, you know, the Stanley Cup can't be played in August. So it needs to be done just about when it needs to be done, by the end of June, is from what I've heard in the past, you know, because there's buildings that have different commitments and different things like that. So you're really looking at, you know, really looking at D-Day coming now. So hopefully the next time we talk, you know, we'll be talking about some Blackhawk hockey and not the labor relations and all of that. But it's too bad it's come to this. I really feel in a lot of respects, you know, judging from people that I know that have kids in youth hockey and in a lot of different ways, the game really was more popular than probably I've ever seen it. And you just wonder if, you know, if it's just stumbled here, if it's taken a significant step back. And we'll find out. We'll find out soon, I think.
Yeah, you know, you talk about those kids. You know, you have a generation of kids now that losing seasons, half seasons, is becoming just, a fact of the game. And that's sad as well, that you know, the kids growing up, they learn to live without hockey. And I mean, I can't imagine that. I remember, you know, I was a teenager in 94, and that half season was hell. And now you have kids that it's just like it's a way of being a sports fan, that you just go a season or a half season without hockey. And I just that to me is more harmful to the game than I think maybe anything else.
Yeah, and you know, those effects show up in later years, but like I say, hopefully, you know, I could start writing again and talking about hockey. And, you know, you've done a great job following the Ice Hogs, and we'll continue to do so. And hopefully we'll be chatting about things other than the CBA in the near future. And I'm optimistic, but, you know, I wouldn't bet the mortgage that it's going to be done. It just seems to be, if something in my gut says that, you know, this just isn't all going to fall into place this perfectly. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope it ends tonight, but so far I've been right, so I got to stick with that. And although I do think that, you know, we'll find out within the next few days whether we're going to have a year or not. I think if we're still at this point of wavering, you know, next week at this time, then look out. It could be trouble, real trouble.
All right, Alf, if anybody wants to, if you're looking to buy or sell a home, if you're looking to, you've got interest out there in the western suburbs, give Al a call. The number again is 630-522-2005, 630-522-2005. Al, it's a pleasure as always, and hopefully here in the next few weeks we'll get you back on. We'll be talking about the Blackhawks roster and prospects for the season.
I certainly hope so. And to everybody out there, Happy New Year and a healthy one, and let's get this done and get going.
All right, guys. I want to thank everybody for listening. We'll be back. You know, January is a difficult month for me, but because of what's going on here with the CBA and the season going to be starting up, I'll find time. But when exactly that is and all that, we'll figure that out. But everybody, thanks for listening. Again, Al, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your New Year's Day. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk next time. Good night, everybody.
Circles perfect, eyes within your face. My heart's an open wound that only you replace. And though the moon is rising, can't put your picture down. Love can be frightening when you
between your legs.
Yeah, so?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I forgot who I was dealing with.
What's the worst thing that can happen?
Well, you'd be embarrassed and humiliated in front of a large group of people and have to walk out and shame.